Good, Scott, but do you think I'm in?
Yeah, you're in. I mean, I can hear you, and I can't see you on the iPad, but that's fine. We don't need the video. I know what you look
Hold
like.
on, hold on. Start video. Okay, we got Evelyn, Grammy, and me here.
Wow. All right. Good deal.
Now, we do know that some of this may be above Evie's pay grade.
Yeah,
She's not.
I was going to say one of the questions that came up was, I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it. It was about Franca was pregnant more than six times. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
So that was, I'll tell you what, let me close my door here real quick just so we don't get interrupted. One second.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah,
So,
I can run through that since it all happened after me and before Julie.
yeah, so one of the things that came up, so I've gotten some feedback and some people had some questions, and Julie talked about it a little bit, and I'm just hoping as the de facto patriarch of the family, if perhaps you could elaborate. The story that I heard was that Franca had one miscarriage, and then did she have a stillbirth, or the other baby was alive for a couple days, John said maybe?
No, it actually was the opposite.
Okay.
So he had a after me and before Julie, she had a live birth. His name was Robert, but he only lived for hours.
Okay.
And the reason he only lived for hours, he had an incomplete air tube from his mouth to his lungs.
Oh, wow.
Just like the John Kennedy baby, the Kennedy baby
Is it
that
like when
died,
it connects to your
so
stomach
they
to
only
your throat
had
on a
two
song,
instead
I
of three
guess?
kids. It was the exact same physical deformity. And back then, they didn't know what to do about it. Today, they would fix it.
Oh, so it's repairable, or at least
Yeah,
now.
it is now.
So you said that was after you were born, but before Julie.
That's correct.
So you were too little to remember this then. I mean, you just only heard about
That just my mother told me about it, and it was in 1948.
And then she had a miscarriage as well later.
Yeah, and the way I remember this, my dad told me this story, and again, I was too little to remember, but mom was pretty devastated after losing Robert,
Yeah, right.
pregnant right away. And then she had a really tough miscarriage that put her in the hospital. And the doctor told her that she had cancer and she would never have children, any more children.
Where in the line did this miscarriage come in?
This came in after Robert, but before Julie.
So she had two. Oh my gosh, that's got to be devastating, right?
Right. And that's when Grandma came over because she
Oh.
was a. Mom was a mess. Dad called to have grandma come over. Julie remembers that the grandma got there when she was born, but that's pretty true. But I think she got there before Julie was born
So
to help.
how many years are there between you and Julie then?
Two and a quarter.
Oh, wow. That's, huh.
Two and a half. There was a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, that's a really busy 2.5 years for Franca. I mean, that's a lot
Yeah.
to go through emotionally.
Apparently, the two, mom and dad, had a very rough emotional period. And we were in Chicago, Illinois when that happened. And dad's boss, who dad really always talked fondly about, helped dad tremendously because dad didn't have a car and he just gave him his car to use during this period. And supported him having not to be at work all the time. Dad was the office manager for a big manufacturing representative firm. Back then, you didn't have the internet or anything. So the way that if you built things, made things, wanted to sell things, you did it through these firms. And Dad worked for one of those firms that represented things like white refrigerator, Ideal Toy Company. And then the salesman that worked for this company would go out and sell this stuff to the department stores, etc.
Wow.
Then mom got, even though the doctor said she'd never get pregnant again, she was determined and she got pregnant again. Then we had Julie, and then.
So the doctor told her that she wasn't going to be able to get pregnant again, and then she went on and had five more kids?
Right.
Wow.
And dad's boss encouraged dad to sue the doctor for incompetence, but he didn't do it.
Wow, that's a crazy story. Well, now I'm glad I asked, because I had no idea it was that. That's crazy.
It was pretty crazy.
So,
that,
I mean...
that was all in South Chicago, when dad was working in Chicago.
So the other thing, and you kind of alluded to this already, is that somebody reached out and they had a couple questions about what... Does Frank have any siblings?
No.
So she was an only child living in Italy.
Correct.
Your dad's in the army. He's over in Italy and he meets her.
Correct.
They fall in love. She doesn't speak English. She doesn't speak a lot of Italian, right?
Correct. They share French.
Oh, I didn't know. So they were able to speak to each other in French?
Correct.
Oh, wow. So that, walk me through that scenario. So do they get married over there?
Correct.
So do you know how long they were together before they got married?
Probably less than a year. And they really weren't together. Dad was, you know, this is in the war.
Right.
But dad was living in my mom's apartment building in the basement. Julie and I actually visited that apartment building. So it was a skinny little apartment building with two apartments per floor, and dad was down in the basement, which he took me down there. It's obviously after the war, it was just a basement with stuff stored in it. Mm-hmm. During the war, dad and his buddy lived down there. There was one of those little elevators that went up, and I don't know how tall the building was, Scott, maybe 6-8 floors. And mom and her mother had one of those apartments. Her uncle had another apartment. And as I mentioned, grandma, her mother, Nana, had all these sisters who did not have kids. And Nana Julie only had one kid because I don't know why. They just had one. And part of it might have been is my grandmother was pretty unique. She was a science professor back when women didn't do that kind of thing.
Right.
And her dad was a principal. I think that's how her dad and her mother met. They were both educators. And so anyway, they met, got married. They got married late. And Franca was born when Nana was 36. And then mom was only 13 when her father passed away before the war. And then during the war, mom and her mother were living together in this apartment. And as Julie mentioned, Nana's fear was that mom would never get married because mom wasn't a big social gal, so she didn't run around looking for guys or anything.
So that was going to be my question, is do you agree with Julie's assessment? Because the weird thing is she meets this guy in the army and then she moves to a completely different country where she doesn't speak the language. I'm thinking from a parent's point of view, how old was Franca when they got married?
I think 24.
So I'm just thinking, so your 24-year-old daughter comes to you and says, hey, I met this army guy. We're going out.
It didn't work like that, Scott.
No?
The army guy met the whole family.
Oh, okay.
Through her uncle. And everything's very formal back then. You don't just say, hey, let's go out on a date.
Right.
As mom told me, she never went on a date with dad in Italy without her youngest aunt tailing along as a chaperone.
Oh, because they're good, strict Italians, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. That's just the way you do it in Italy.
See, everything I learned about dating in Italy, I learned from The Godfather. So that definitely happens.
Well, then you know what it's like.
Right? I never thought about it. Okay, so I was just trying to, how does that conversation go? So they get married and she's like, Mom, I'm going to go move to America.
Okay, here's how it went. It's actually pretty straightforward and has to do with the war. So the war in Europe ends. Dad and the entire army hospital that he works in has been told that they are now to get on a ship in Naples, south of Rome, and prepare to leave to go to the Western Front and fight the Japanese. So when Dad hears this, he goes, holy mackerel, I may not live. So I've met the love of my life. I'm going to ask her to marry me. So he just popped the question. And again, you don't just pop the question to Franca, you pop it to the family. And we have lots of letters from Dad that he wrote home to his parents, quickly introducing his wife-to-be to them and asking for their blessing, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, the Italian side rushes to prepare the wedding in the Catholic Church, only to be rejected because Dad's not Catholic.
Oh, wow.
And so now they have to do it a different way, and they got married in the entrance to the church by the priest.
Oh.
And Dad had to sign a piece of paper that said he would honor my mother's faith and would raise the kids Catholic.
Wow. So did he ever convert to Catholicism?
Nope, but he always told us he would, but he never did.
Interesting. So Franca's mom was probably just pretty happy that she found somebody, because like you said, I think Julie kind of called her a spinster. Like, they didn't think she was going to get married.
Yeah. I think that Julie had a better handle on that than me. That's not something that I would have talked to my mother about,
right,
or my grandmother, but I think Julie did. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the way it went down. Now, you asked, Mom would always tell me, I don't know where I got the courage to do what I did, but it just came and I did it. But
I mean, especially at a young age, to meet somebody and move cross country, that's a huge lifestyle change, right?
Absolutely. To leave Rome, Italy. And my mother was not a peasant by any means. I would call her upper middle class. And she's leaving this life in Italy behind to go to a country she knows very little about on a U.S. hospital ship that's been converted to haul all the war wives back to the States.
Wow.
So every single person on the ship that she came to New York on was a new bride that married a GI heading for Japan.
They're starting a franchise. Wow.
Yeah, it was. It was the Italian franchise. Now, the next thing, Scott, is Dad's about half, and I think Julie told you this, Dad's about halfway across the Atlantic when the atom bomb was dropped and Dad found out the war was over.
Oh, wow.
So then everything went into super gear. They started to wind down the troops. They sent Dad to a fort in Alabama where he was decommissioned or whatever. And then Dad hustled on home, except that his home wasn't where it was when he left for the war. So he had to hustle to a new place called Fremont, Ohio. He had left from Connecticut. He's a Connecticut Yankee. But when he came back, his parents had moved during the war to Ohio. He knows nothing about Ohio, and he has no desire to stay in. And his dream is go to California. So he does go to California. Unfortunately, in those days, with all the guys coming home from the war, competing for a job away from your home was tough, even though he had a degree. He said that people would, you know, say, where are you from? And if you said Connecticut, they'd go, well, we're giving the California boys the jobs here first.
Wow.
So anyway, he went back to Fremont, and his dad, his father had moved to Fremont to run a gun manufacturing plant in Port Clinton, where I was born. And when the war ended, the plant shut down, and then his dad started Fremont White Truck, which sold 18-wheelers. And so dad didn't want to do anything with that. Dad wasn't mechanical or anything. So he became, he had a degree in from Dartmouth, so he pretty much could call his shots. And he got a business job with a company called the Wolf Company in Fremont. Then he started to busy himself to figure out how to get mom over. And he got her onto this troop ship with all these wives. And they, I think she came into the United States in 1946. She tells me it was really rainy and cold. So I'm going to assume it was spring or fall, but I guess I could do the math. I was born in February, and she said she got pregnant almost immediately. So if you back 9 months or 10 months off of February, that's probably when she arrived in New York.
Yeah, so sometime in the summer. Huh.
I think it was fall, I think it was the spring of 46.
So you alluded to it a little bit, and maybe I don't understand the chronology here. So when does when and how does Franca's mom decide to come live with you guys?
Okay, so, well, let me just end one thing.
Okay.
Dad's finding out that he's going to go to fight right over in Japan. He mm-hmm. asked her to get married, but now he's shipped out to Naples. So dad goes to his commanding officer and says that I got to marry this gal. He says, I'll tell you what, Art, I'm going to give you 5 days. So he calls, writes, whatever they do, sent the Pony Express, however he did it, and tells my mom, I'm coming back up to Rome. I'm on leave. I'm bringing my buddy to be the best man. We need to get married. And they threw that wedding together in like a week. Then and dad gets married. He has one night honeymoon, and back to Naples he goes.
That's wow.
The story. That's the story.
And so how does, where, what's Franca's mom's name? I don't think I know.
Julia.
So, and so how does Julia end up coming to live with you guys then?
Okay. Now, when she had that, remember I told you she lost the baby.
Right.
Then she has a miscarriage. It's really a bad one.
Right.
And she kind of falls apart.
Man,
and dad.
Understandably so, sure.
And dad told me he wasn't in too good a shape. I'm around. I'm kicking around. And they just put me on the street to live by myself. I was two, so I was big enough to handle it.
That's not true.
And South Chicago's a nice place. So, no. But trying to go to work, raise me, go through all this trauma, he gets a hold of my grandmother and asks her to come over, and she agrees.
Where's your grandfather at this time?
Dead.
So had he been dead for a while? So she's living on her own over in Italy?
Correct. He died when my mother was 13. So about 11 years earlier than the time period we're talking about. Actually more than that. 15 years before the time period we're talking about, he had died from cancer.
Okay. And so your dad has this idea to have Franca's mom essentially come help and I assume act as a therapist and try and get their lives back together after these two events.
Yeah. And I don't know if you ever met my grandmother, but she was about as solid as a rock you could be. So for dad, I'm sure he's thinking, I need a rock in my life right now.
Sure. And so she comes over. I mean, and obviously things worked out because, I mean, she went on to have five more kids and you guys have really good stories to tell of your grandmother. She sounds like she was a good influence on you guys.
She was phenomenal. She was when she came over, we lived in a little tiny house and her and I shared a bedroom. So she was my best buddy because I'm like 3 years old and she's the nicest person in the world. And even though
you want to go down,
I couldn't speak a lot of Italian, I could understand it. So she lived in my bedroom. So the two of us were buddies.
And how long did you, how old were you when she died?
She died when she was 100.
Nine.
This is the funny part. This is the funny part of the story, Scott. She gets there at, this is the way my dad tells me. She got there, she was 65 years old. Dad said, what the hell? She's only going to live for maybe 5-10 years. My dad never lived without my grandmother in this house.
Wow.
Until she died.
I'm just thinking the logistics. I mean, now that you explain it, it makes sense. Cause I mean, he needed her help, but I'm trying to think of what it would take for me to call my mother-in-law and say, will you come live with me? That's a tough ask, but I guess in this scenario, it makes sense.
That's a tall order.
For sure. But I mean, obviously it worked out and she lived.
I would have done it with Sherry's mom because it takes a certain kind of personality. And Nana had that personality. A, she knew her role. B, she never overstepped it. So she never interfered with my parents raising us. And if she had any comments, she did them in private with my mother. They were never done in front of us. So for us, she was just this matriarch who lived with us and worked around the house and smiled every day and went to church with us on Sunday and just a cool person.
Was she a pretty happy person, pretty upbeat person?
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
So she was kind of opposite of Franca, because at least when I knew Franca, she's kind of grumpy.
Yep. Yep. She had the exact opposite personality.
So none of her sparkling personality rubbed off on Franca?
No.
Now, she even knew that Mom was struggling with
depression,
and towards the end she was even diagnosed with worse than depression. She was bipolar.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
so she was diagnosed bipolar late in life.
Right, she was fighting that her whole life, and what kept the glue that kept her going was her kids. And when Mark finally left, then she really didn't have a job anymore.
And she fell apart.
And then she fell apart.
Oh, well, that makes sense. I mean, that happens. I mean, your whole purpose in life is all of a sudden
gone.
Yeah, I get that. Right.
Yep.
So that was the two big things I want to talk about. I had two other questions that people asked me about.
Okay.
Number one was, there was a request for you to tell the James not finishing high school story. James mentioned in his interview, I asked him, how was your college experience? And he said, DNF, did not finish.
That's right.
And then I'm curious, I've heard his side of the story. I'm curious to hear your side of the story. So what happens, James's senior year, he gets to the end, he doesn't graduate, but he's already enlisted in the Army, was what I heard?
Yeah, he did graduate, but it took three bulldozers and two dump trucks to get him across the finish line. So he enlisted in the U.S. Army to be a tank operator, a tank driver, etc. That was his dream. He wanted to go 50 miles an hour in an A1 Abram tank and fire off a couple rounds before he hit the ground. That was his goal. So we go see the recruiters. I want him to go in the Air Force and get some technical training and be an IT guy. And he looked at me like I had four eyes in my head. And he said, Dad, I'm going to go do something that you can't do in civilian life. So we went and saw the Army guy. I told the guy, hey, this kid of mine wants to do something he can't do anywhere else. And the guy puts a videotape on that shows this A1 Abram launching at about 60 miles an hour, fires off a couple cannons, and then hits the ground. Jane goes, that's what I want to do. So the recruiter said, fine, we need people like you. You're going to take a test, blah, blah, blah. And if you can qualify. So he does all that and he qualifies. Meanwhile, now he decides that high school isn't necessary anymore because he's going to be driving tanks and shooting bad guys.
Oh.
So he fails to go to class in one of his, what do you call it, mandatory classes that you have to pass, called American Government, just up James's alley in America. He doesn't go to class. Well, the principal of the high school, and Sherry and I are good buddies, and I get a call from the principal, and he says, hey, George, James is going to the Army, right? I said, yeah. Does he need his diploma? I said, well, of course he does. Well, he hasn't been coming to class. So he fails. He cannot graduate. So I go to the principal. I said, look, he's got to graduate. The kid's ready to go. And so blah, blah, blah. He said, I'll tell you what. I've got an advanced course in this offered this summer. It's 1 month. And after 4 weeks, he has to come to class every day, takes a test. If he passes, he gets his diploma. Well, he's 5 weeks out to reporting to the Army. So he's got just enough time. So I sit him down. We have a long talk. And I get the old, I know, Dad. Yep, I'm going to buckle down, Dad. I will go every day, Dad. And that lasted about 3 days. But unbeknownst to him, I had spies that were watching him at school. And the minute that he didn't show up for class one day, I'm on the phone. I find that out. He gets home. I get home. And I read him the riot act. And he goes, I know, Dad. I'm going to buckle down. Well, we go through this I know, Dad crap about four times. And he goes and takes the final test. And he passes by 1 point. He has to get a 70%. He got a 71. And then he got his diploma. And then they came and got him and took him away for the Army. After the Army, he gets, because he was in the Army, now he can go to college, right?
Right.
On the U.S. government. So he signs up twice, once in Kansas, and he was taking business courses, and he left. I don't even know anything about that. He was in there for about a quarter or two quarters or semesters. He comes back. He moves back in with us. He signs up at Dell Tech. And he takes business courses again. And about halfway through the semester, he tells me that he met a guy in class, and the two of them decided that instead of investing in stupid classes, that they would take the money and invest it in a real business and make it work. And he said, Dad, loan me the money, and then you won't have to pay anymore for this college stuff with the government, and we're going to make this work. And so I did. I loaned him the money.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. He got in that business, and he's doing fine.
Wow, that is a crazy story. Okay, I'm glad I asked now.
So when he said did not finish, that almost applied to did not finish is definitely his college experience. Did not finish was almost his high school experience.
Were you concerned that he wasn't going to pass?
Absolutely.
Did you have a contingency plan if he didn't pass?
No,
I really didn't, Scott. It was like, you're going to pass. Because he had his heart set on going in the Army. It would have been devastating. So we had to get him through it, but He had checked out and was moving on in high school, and to get him reengaged was almost impossible.
Sure. Well, it looks like he's dialed in now, so good for him. Everybody's got their own path, right?
Yep, that's right. But yeah, that's the did not finish though does apply to college, that's for sure. Being a son-in-law. Yeah, okay. Got it. You may have never seen the book that Mark put together on Dad's journal from World War II.
No, you know what? Angie and I had just started dating when Mark was doing all that. So I remember seeing the book, but I don't think I was able to put two and two together because I didn't know the people involved.
Yeah. Well, if you borrow it from John.
Okay.
And you read it from start to end, all this stuff will just come together because Dad wrote diaries and a lot of letters, and they're all in there.
Okay. All right. I will talk to John about that.
Okay. All right. It's the, just tell John it's the red book, the burgundy book.
Right.
Because there's also, there's also a black book on family history.
So I have, I have one last kind of super quick kind of snarky question, and then I, if Sherry has time, I'd curious to hear her story about your meeting. But
I already told her that she wasn't allowed to tell it.
I'll have to, I might have to go around your, your.
No, she's ready. She's dying to talk.
I bet she is. So just to give a little backstory to this, I would say it's probably about once every 6 months, maybe once a year, I get an email from Uncle George, and it's completely unprompted, and it has something to do with...
Atlas Shrugged.
It, can you hear the smoke alarm going off in my house?
No.
Oh, wow, that's really... My wife's downstairs cooking dinner.
Oh.
So about once every 6 months, once a year, I get an email from Uncle George, completely unprompted, and it's something about Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Right. It's so not snarky. It's not snarky. You and I have had this discussion.
I want to go on the record. What do you like about Atlas Shrugged? Obviously it speaks to you because it keeps coming up a lot.
Okay. Here's what it is. Here's what it is. It's just a logic trail. You ready for the logic?
Yeah. I read Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. I haven't read Atlas Shrugged though.
Fountainhead sucks. Okay. So Scott Baker likes to read.
That's true.
Scott Baker likes to explore different thoughts about different things more than anybody that I know in your age group. None of my kids are interested in the kinds of things you like to dig into.
I see.
So when I was your age, actually younger than you, I met a young lady. This is before I got married. And she was kind of leading edge women's liber. And I thought she was really had some interesting thoughts about things. Well, I met her through work. She was one of the early engineers female that we hired at Mobile. So anyway, I'm talking to her at lunch one day and she pulls a book out, slaps it down on the table, and the sucker's thicker than anything I'd ever seen.
Yeah, it's a big book.
You've got to read this, George. And she starts talking to me about some of the themes and stuff in the book. And I said, that sounds kind of interesting. And it's a book written for extremely logical people. If you got a lot, if you're a big feeler, it ain't going to work for you. And so the Democrats typically hate this book. I mean, hate it. If they ever hear that any Republican candidate reads this book, they immediately throw it back in their face and call them bad names.
She has a reputation amongst economists for sure, right?
Yeah. And she also probably would align mostly with people that are more libertarian than Democrat, sure. Yep. Republican. Okay. So she's more in that vein. And I don't subscribe to everything Ayn Rand talks about, but I found parts of it extremely interesting as my life clicked off. Because the thing I'm reading this in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it took a whole summer to read it. And the book was in my back pocket. So at work, if I wasn't doing anything, I would sneak off and read and put it back in my pocket, go back to work. And I was working as a mechanic for Pacific Power and Light. So, I mean, I had to do real things with my hands all the time. Well, it wasn't easy to get time, but this book had me so fascinated. I couldn't lay it down. It went to work with me.
It's definitely interesting. I mean, it's like an 1100 or 1200 page book. It's very dense.
So, Mike, again, you said, well, why do I do that? Because I really want you to read it. That's all.
It's definitely on my radar. I haven't been able to sink my teeth into a 1000+ page book yet. It's interesting to hear you explain the philosophy behind it. So it's very, I guess, is it right brain? Right brain is the very logical piece.
No, I think instead it's really about society moving to the point that it moved to in the 60s when she wrote it. It was either late 50s or 60s she wrote it, and where she felt it would fall apart, where it wouldn't be able to sustain itself. And it has to do with, there's a group of people that have a mindset to keep the machines running, and the rest of them either don't care or don't appreciate. And what finally happens, the machines stop running. So the railroads stop running, the planes stop flying, industry grinds to a halt, and it's one ugly ending to society the way people knew it in the 60s.
Have you read it since then?
I always sat there and I go, dang, I see a little of this stuff happening. She feels that it comes about through less accountability, less responsibility, more entitlement. It's kind of, to me, if you think about, why did Rome go from great to nothing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end, Scott, the emperors paid the people to go watch sporting events because they didn't have to work anymore. And so you just had to keep them entertained. And pretty soon they, you know, human beings need to work. I mean, that's always my philosophy. And yeah, without work, they start looking around and going, well, what the heck is this life about? I mean, you know,
what's, and then some of them go, get into?
Yeah, exactly. And then some of them go, well, you know, let's go start a war, or let's go kill people. Or
have you read it since you were, have you read it as an adult, I should say?
No.
I'm curious if your view of it would change. There was, in high school, I read Catcher in the Rye. Have you read Catcher in the Rye?
I did, way back.
It's about a high school kid who just, you know, kind of, he fails out of school and, you know, basically goes off on his own in New York. And I remember reading it in a high school and going, God, this kid, he's got it all figured out. You know, screw the system. He doesn't have to go to school. He can do his own, you know, he's his own man, right? He's like this 17-year-old kid or whatever.
Yeah.
And I really like connected with the kid, you know, as when I was in high school. And then so I reread it as an adult, and I read it like just recently, like within the last couple of years. And I just, yes, I've never hated a character more. Like, I just look at it now and I'm like, you are such a whiny, entitled 17-year-old. Like, it was just so weird, like, that I had two visceral reactions to the same book.
That's funny.
I'm curious if. I'll tell you what. I will put.
Okay, I'm going to turn you over to Sherry.
I will put Atlas Shrugged on my list. It's been on my list for a while. I just checked Amazon. It is 1,088 pages. So
there you go.
It's definitely. I know
you can handle it, Scott.
All right. I will let you know.
And here's the fun. This is the fun part, Scott. Once you read it, then we can have some discussions.
All right. We'll have a book club.
That's right. That's right. On Zoom. We have Zoom now.
All right. Deal.
Okay.
Now, all right, George. Thank you.
Now, remember, Sherry likes to embellish and stuff, so.
Yeah, Sherry's known for embellishing. Right.